Welcome to After Hours at the Book Club. It is a podcast and it's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran and Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore is our co-host. And we've heard as part of our monthly book club from Mona Awad, 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl. But we're delighted to have her join us for After Hours at the Book Club.
Thanks so much for letting me join you.
So when you were writing this book, you know, we were just talking in the studio, did you have particular people you thought of or particular, I don't want to say horror stories, but extreme examples of body image issues that you thought, I got to get that into the book somehow, or that inspired you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I did kind of, I had like a mental notebook for years of stuff that I was just kind of observing and thinking, oh gosh, this is just... This is intense. I'm thinking I wanted to write about all of this stuff. But I think in the end, I kind of the people in the book are kind of composites of their stand-ins, their relationships that I think, you know, most of us have. You know, there's the mother, there's the father, there's lovers, there's you know, there's friends that are bigger, there's friends that are smaller, you know. I just wanted to make sure that I kind of examined each of those relationships and how I was really interested in examining how those relationships impacted Lizzie's way of seeing herself and of kind of seeing the relationship too.
Uh-huh. You know, one thing that was really interesting to me was, and a little bit horrifying too, was
right.
how it affected her sex life and how it affected yeah. her as a mm-hmm. high school girl dealing with sex,
yeah.
how it affected her with when she works at the bookstore and the guy picks her up by just basically writing a sex act on a piece of paper. And
right.
she feels guilty that she didn't respond
yeah.
nicely to him when actually yeah. that could be cause for workplace sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And maybe talk about that and how
sure.
how her body image affects her sex life as she goes through
well,
time.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, in the book, I wanted to kind of follow this girl and just show again how pervasive body image is. So I wanted, you know, go out to lunch with friends, hang out with the mother. She obviously has to have sex. I think that I wanted to look at how body image issues can kind of create this way of seeing yourself that is, you know, really like very, very damaging to your self-esteem. And it having that kind of self-esteem can invite, you know, very kind of damaging sexual relationships. I wanted to kind of look closely at that and tell those stories because I thought they were very important.
Writing this book, 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl, did you become kind of even more aware of how society and culture here in the US, or really any Western country, really has that bizarre mix of here's all this food, you can
yeah.
be gluttonous,
God.
But also you're supposed to be really, really skinny.
Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the disparity of that, you know, like the incongruity, it's just so glaring sometimes that it's mind boggling. And I had to kind of examine it in story because I find it fascinating, but I also find it horrifying.
And especially around food, because you cannot live without it. I mean,
absolutely.
If you know, not to label all food issues as an addiction, but you mm-hmm. cannot live without food. And that's what seems to be so tragic, certainly for Elizabeth, because you still need to eat. It's not like you can avoid alcohol or you can avoid drugs and, you know, completely separate yourself
right.
from a substance that you've an issue with. You
right.
have got to eat. And
absolutely.
So you will always have a relationship with food.
Absolutely. It's such a sadomasochistic thing. It really, really is. I think it's very disturbing what we do. We're encouraged and invited to consume. And at the same time, we are also encouraged to be as slender as possible and look, you know, and I just don't understand how those two things are possible.
I was yeah. really excited about this book, co-hosting with Arsene from a male perspective on this, because this book is so it will resonate with so many women
mm-hmm.
around body image issues. And Arsene, you said, of course, you know, you have friends who are women, a mother, a wife and a daughter too. I mean,
yeah.
did this make you think about modeling appropriate food behavior
yeah.
for a young girl?
And we try to be as healthy as we can, you know, of our family, the one who's least healthy about food is probably me, actually. You know, I've always had I've always been, you know, slightly overweight, and but it doesn't pervade my life like it does this character's in the same way. Every now and then I'll get on the scale in the morning and be like, oh, I got to lose 3 pounds.
Right.
And then I walk out the door and I don't even think about it for the next, you know, couple days till I get on the scale again. I'm like, oh, right. I lost one of those pounds. Great. And I don't think about it.
Yeah.
And so what I thought was really interesting and kind of tragic in some ways is how it pervades. It doesn't just end there. I mean, maybe I won't eat French fries for lunch for a few days, or I'll try to straighten out. But, it, you know, it's really pervasive here. And I thought some of the best passages on food were the story, the chapter from her husband's point of view, when he's describing mm-hmm. the food she's trying to eat when she's losing and how mm-hmm. unappealing it is to him. Mm-hmm. And then they end up going to a barbecue, which you can tell is appealing to him.
Right.
And I think that was difficult for him. He wants to be supportive, but at the same
right.
time, he sees you're getting an objective look of what she's trying to do.
Right.
Here.
Well, I think it's, I mean, I think those, like when you're trying to change, you know, when you're, you do have to make sacrifices, and, you know, Lizzie is making these very kind of draconian choices, and it affects her social life. I mean, it affects her ability to be social. It affects her ability to be close. And I actually think that that's for anybody who's trying to change anything, you know, giving up coffee, giving up alcohol, giving up food, going on a diet, going on some sort of very specific diet, restricted diet. It does change the social dynamic between you and everybody else around you, because everybody is always noticing, like they can't help but notice if they're partaking and you don't partake. It creates a weird tension suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really important to show. You
and
know?
It really impacts every part of your life. I mean, that's actually so true as you say that. I mean, I've had friends who haven't gone to major social events, like have skipped weddings.
Absolutely.
Because they just cannot be around food. They just can't,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it really just impacts everything.
Yeah, I think it really does. And I think that's something I wanted to show, is those choices do affect your relationships, and how do you make sure that they don't, or how do you kind of navigate that terrain? I think it's very difficult for people, you know.
Yeah, I became a vegetarian in 1989, and now I added fish back into my diet some years ago. But those first 5 to 10 years of being a vegetarian, it became hard for me to navigate, especially when I went home to any family gathering.
Right.
You know, I'm Armenian, and there's a lot of lamb, and there's
right.
all these feasts. And especially
yeah.
if I hadn't been home in 6 months, they want to have a big feast for me, you know.
Right.
And that was very difficult.
Yeah.
And food is such a part of so many different cultures, and it's a way of nourishing, it's a way of celebrating. And so when you have in any way a weird relationship with food, that can impact that as well.
I think so, too. I think it's also, you know, it's a way of bonding. You know, and it's a way that I think families bond. I think it's a way that women bond. I think it's a way that lovers bond. So when you have to make a change like the one that Lizzie makes for herself, I mean, those bonds, what happens to them? And
yeah,
how do they get compromised?
Her and her husband can't really sit down to dinner together.
Right.
And that starts changing their relationship. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's one of the things that just the fact that they can't quite do it.
Right.
You know, or she gets home one day and he's already had takeout barbecue or something, and he says, well, I'll sit with you, but
yeah, right
and
yeah.
That's very difficult and sad.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the book there's like, she has like a, you know, like a treat night where they go out, and he looks forward to that night because that night she's actually really fun to hang out with, because she's enjoying herself and she can relax, and he looks forward to that.
But know? Then the guilt sets in,
and the guilt
before
sets
they can
in.
Even get home and have sex.
Right, exactly.
Like, he doesn't even get
she's
the payoff.
She's too full. She can't. Yeah, she doesn't want to do anything.
You've said that you were very deliberate about using the word fat in the
yes.
title and throughout the entire book, because it's
mm-hmm.
a word that's so full of stigma
yes.
in many ways. And you know, what are your thoughts on how we talk about weight as a culture? Because it seems now, whether or not we have the subtext of people feeling shame about their body image, it seems the dominant narrative now is around health. OK, and we use terms
mm-hmm.
like obesity or BMI, body
mass
index,
yeah.
and numbers, and try to make it a little bit more clinical. But
mm-hmm.
essentially, we're saying the same thing, that there's some number that we should aspire to or some body figure. And now we're framing those conversations around health
mm-hmm.
and people are guilted into, well, now you're just unhealthy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really difficult thing, because, you know, there is this medical aspect to it that, you know, is out there. It's absolutely valid. But I don't know. I feel like despite, you know, fat positivity movements and things like that. And despite seeing people on TV that I'm so happy to see finally on TV, like people like Christina Hendricks and Lena Dunham make me so happy, you know, and but I do think that we still, when I overhear women in fitting rooms and when I overhear women, you know, having, you know, drinks together and stuff, I still hear like the same conversations, you know, and they're not really framed any differently. They still sound like women who are fixated on their weight, you know, in unhealthy ways. And where is that coming from? Well, it's coming from somewhere, right? So I don't know how much has changed, but I want things to change, you know.
The earliest that we meet Elizabeth, Lizzie, I think she is when we first meet her, it's in high school.
Right.
But the relationship with her mother and certainly her father, because there is a very poignant passage later on in the book where she talks about a photograph with her father and it's the last time she thinks she's looked at a camera straight in the lens.
Right.
But we obviously know about the relationship between her and her mother,
mm-hmm.
but we first meet them, I suppose, in high school. And yet it seems that, I mean, our first relationship with our mothers is around feeding.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship that a lot of mothers have with their kids is around food and nourishment. And so the complexity of having a relationship with a mother who is dealing with her own weight issues, mm-hmm. who's very conscious of your weight issues, and then this whole weird food thing, when really it seems at the basis level, a mother-child relationship is about food and nourishment kind of in a positive way, and somehow it's gotten distorted.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what I feel those body image issues really do, you know. You're right. I mean, that's kind of the way that Lizzie bonds with her mother, but it's also a way that they bond that's very damaging too, and that perpetuates a kind of, you know, mindset that's like, we're fixated on this, you know, but that's also how they're close. So it's tough, you know. Writing about it was a real challenge. I wanted to really try to be truthful about it. Yeah
And the father plays into that complexity because he left and she describes him as having secretary/mistresses.
Right.
So, you know, there's always that thought probably as a girl growing up.
Right.
You know, why
Absolutely.
Did dad leave? Mom mm-hmm. was kind of overweight. And
right.
And
yeah.
So that adds the complexity.
All of that for sure. That's true.
I wanted to switch tack just a little bit and actually ask Arson a question. I mean, Uh-oh. As a bookseller, we're talking so much about how we fetishize food. We've got cookbooks. We also have every diet going. And it seems as a new diet comes out every year. I mean, do you see this as a trend at the bookstore, at the Boulder bookstore, where you're seeing a certain diet the news and then we get like all the recipe books sell?
Well, certainly the last 5, 6, 7 years, it's been the big gluten-free and paleo diet yes. thing's been going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, a certain percentage of the population has celiac disease. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's 1%. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's low, but it is there. It's, you know, and it's important that those people do need to have gluten-free cookbooks. But the amount of gluten-free cookbooks would be, you would think 30% of the population has right. celiac disease or some other gluten intolerant. It's like if something's wrong, you don't have a good mood, you're not able to lose weight, it must be because you have some gluten intolerance, even though you don't have celiacs. And so that's really taken over the section, you know,
yeah.
in the last few years. And I find that a little frightening myself, having, you know, grown up loving pasta and things like that.
Right.
But it just makes me wonder, it's like food is somehow going to be the answer for these things that ail you. And it can't be the answer. It needs to be nourishment. The food serves other purposes than just being the answer to why you wake up tired. You know, maybe you went to sleep at 2 a.m. I don't know. But,
right.
And so I think that's been very interesting the last few years, how many of these gluten-free books we have.
But that's interesting. I was a gluten skeptic and I would make these snide remarks. I'll have my gluten on the side or I'll have extra gluten at my dinner. And then my daughter was actually diagnosed with a gluten issue. We got lab tests done. It wasn't just something woke up and did. And I started to really pay attention to it. And we talked about, you know, the difficulties if you have any kind of food issue in terms of eating out or family gatherings. And you do have to definitely be mm-hmm. so aware. So I'm kind of new to the whole, we've got a gluten issue
And there are definitely people who have gluten issues. And I think that's why it's great that there's these books that they can help them with.
But there's a lot of self-diagnosis.
There's a lot of self-diagnosis. And I wonder how much good that really does. I have a question on a totally different topic for Mona. So my wife saw this book sitting in the house, and she's an English teacher. And she said, oh, is that a play on Wallace Stevens, 13 mm-hmm. Ways of Looking at a Blackbird? Which mm-hmm. then I went and read the poem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can you tell us? You have a great English background.
Yeah, it was. I wanted to write about this subject for so long, and I really struggled with the form forever. I mean, I wrote a poem, and then I wrote, I wrote a nonfiction article for a magazine, and I wrote a screenplay. And there was just nothing felt right. Like, you know, nothing felt like that it allowed me the freedom to really examine body image from all these different kind of perspectives and look really closely at how body image can affect these different relationships. And then when I read that poem, I don't know, something just opened up and I was like, wow, I can, this form will allow me to do exactly that. And so I decided to kind of make the title a tribute to the poem.
Has it been cathartic in any way? Because you did say you've had your own body image issues.
Yeah, I think it has been. I think there was a lot that I wanted to say and a lot that I wanted to kind of explore. And I think writing this book kind of allowed me to do that. And I think it was good.
I asked you earlier what reaction you're getting, because this will resonate with so many people who've had either a body image issue or know somebody who has. And it's pretty much everybody who's listening right now.
Yeah.
There's also so much judgment that goes along with talking about weight. Mm-hmm. And so have you heard from people who are like, don't glorify this? Not that you do glorify it, but
right,
you know, there's a lot of judgment, you know, if you read the comment section under a newspaper article or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
A lot of people are very judgmental about weight.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think it's a very provocative book, and I meant it to be so. I mean, I had strong feelings about these issues, and I had stories that I really wanted to tell, and the stories are they're a mix of light and dark, so I'm sure that they're kind of charged for a lot of readers, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
So what's next for you? This is such a great debut, and you're in the DU program for a PhD. But what can we expect from you in the near future?
I'm working on a novel. I'm about two-thirds of the way through, and I'm loving it. It's wonderful. Feels like a fever dream, especially after this book, because this book was a real labor of love. This one is kind of a bit more, it has some elements of the supernatural in it. So it's a bit of a departure, but a very fun one. Yeah.
Can't wait. Well, as we are kind of towards the end of 2016, what have been your own personal favorites in terms of reading? What are you reading right now, and what have you really enjoyed reading this year?
Okay, well, I mean, I am a PhD student, so I just finished comps, which meant that I read, you know, like 100 books this summer, but none of them from this year. Shakespeare was my major figure, so I really, really got into the plays, which made me love Hagseed by Margaret Atwood. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just an ingenious take on The Tempest. And even if you haven't read The Tempest, it's still a wonderful book.
You know, there's a lot of rewriting of Shakespeare going on right now. There's a whole series that Hogarth Books is putting
out. That's right.
Hagseed is a piece of it.
That's right.
But I had read Ian McEwan's latest book, which is Hamlet told from Hamlet being a fetus, though.
Oh, wow. So, I've got to read that.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliantly done. But it's interesting. People want to retell those Shakespearean stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think she just... I'm in awe. I think that book is just brilliant. I think it's brilliant. It's a great, and it's also very dark and kind of thrilling. And yeah, it's wonderful.
Mona Awad has been our guest here after hours at the book club. Her latest book is 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. Check out the book club version of our conversation with Mona Awad and find out more about the Radio Book Club at news.kgnu.org. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, and my co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore.
It's always a lot of fun.